Madrugada de invierno de un año sin precisar, unos minutos antes del amanecer, un jumbo de Air India, secuestrado por un grupo terrorista islámico, está ya en pleno vuelo sobre el Canal de la Mancha. ¿Se oye o no se oye? Madrugada de invierno de un año sin precisar, unos minutos antes del amanecer. Un jumbo de Air India secuestrado por un grupo terrorista islámico estalla en pleno vuelo sobre el Canal de la Mancha. Mientras caen en picado sobre una playa de la costa inglesa, dos pasajeros que han sobrevivido milagrosamente al atentado comentan despreocupadamente la insólita situación en que se encuentran. Así arrancan los versos satánicos, una de las novelas más polémicas de todos los tiempos. El nombre de su autor, Salman Rushdie, adquirió una notoriedad sin precedentes entre millones de personas de Oriente y Occidente que jamás llegarían a abrir el libro. La razón, que en ciertos pasajes figuran alusiones a una religión que se asemeja al Islam, cuyo libro sagrado retoca por su cuenta un escriba imaginario que responde al nombre de Salman. Lo que sucedió tras la publicación de la novela es de sobra conocido. Algunos líderes religiosos musulmanes interpretaron literalmente la estratagema literaria de Rushdie, juzgando que su obra constituía una blasfemia contra el Islam. El gobierno iraní, presidido por el ayatolá Jomeini, promulgó una fetua, condena a muerte, contra el autor, ofreciendo una cuantiosa recompensa a quien ejecutara la sentencia. El libro fue prohibido en numerosos países y quemado en diversos actos de repudia pública, desencadenándose violentos disturbios y manifestaciones que costaron la vida a varias personas en tres continentes. Siguieron años de dificultad extrema para el autor, que se vio obligado a vivir en rigurosa reclusión, cambiando constantemente de domicilio, rodeado día y noche de una escolta de policías secretos que velaban por su integridad física. En 1993 se ratificó la condena a muerte. Tres personas relacionadas con la publicación del libro sufrieron atentados. El traductor de la novela al japonés fue asesinado. El gobierno iraní suspendió oficialmente la condena en 1998, aunque diversos grupos radicales se negaron a acatar la decisión. A fecha de hoy, Rushdie recibe ocasionalmente notas que le recuerdan la fatídica sentencia. En 2005, el ayatolá Ali Jamenei declaró públicamente que la condena seguía en vigor. En 2007, la reina Isabel II de Inglaterra lo nombró Caballero de la Orden del Imperio Británico, gesto que desató una nueva oleada de furia contra Rushdie en amplias zonas del mundo islámico. Durante todo este tiempo, el autor angloindio ha procurado mantenerse fiel a sus principios éticos y estéticos. Entre 2004 y 2006 ejerció como presidente del Pan American Center, organización que desde su sede neoyorquina vela por la libertad de expresión y la independencia de los escritores de todo el mundo. El pasado 25 de noviembre viajó a Estocolmo para tomar parte en un acto a favor de la libertad de opinión celebrado en la Academia Sueca de los Premios Nobel junto a Roberto Saviano, escritor amenazado de muerte por la mafia napolitana. Rushdie puede despertar sentimientos encontrados entre sus compañeros de oficio. Dos autores de gran prestigio que han escrito desde perspectivas muy distintas sobre el Islam se pronunciaron contundentemente en su día sobre la suerte del escritor. El egipcio Naguib Mahfouz, ganador del Premio Nobel de Literatura en 1988, reaccionó a la fetua dictada contra Rushdie, acusando de terrorismo intelectual a Jomeini, para ulteriormente matizar que nadie tiene derecho a ofender las creencias de los demás. La visión de nuestro invitado de hoy es diametralmente opuesta. Sin el derecho a ofender, observó en una ocasión, no se puede hablar de libertad de expresión. En otro momento, apostilló, no hay nada más fácil que impedir que un libro nos ofenda, basta con cerrarlo. Haciendo alarde de su ácido sentido del humor, V.S. Naipaul, premio Nobel de Literatura en 2001 y autor de Viaje al Islam, resumió de modo lapidario el affaire Rushdie, sosteniendo que la fetua pronunciada contra él era un caso de crítica literaria llevada a sus extremos. Tanta humareda nos puede hacer olvidar un dato esencial. Salman Rushdie es uno de los narradores con mayor talento de nuestra época. En opinión de Christopher Hitchens, el controvertido autor de Dios no es bueno, de no haber sido por la condena a muerte hace tiempo que le habrían concedido el Premio Nobel de Literatura. Ingenioso, inventivo y versátil, caracterizado por un rigor y solidez poco comunes, capaz de saltar entre la realidad y la fantasía con asombrosa agilidad, así como de mezclar tradiciones y géneros aparentemente irreconciliables, el corpus novelístico de Salman Rushdie sorprende por la brillantez de su lenguaje, por la audacia de sus planteamientos narrativos y por su destreza técnica. Sir Ahmed Salman Rushdie nació en Bombay el 19 de junio de 1947, 8 semanas y no 6, como se comentaba antes, de que, conforme a la inolvidable imagen que da inicio a Hijos de la Medianoche, las agujas del reloj se unieran tras sonar las 12 campanadas que saludaron el nacimiento de la India como nación independiente. Estudió en una de las escuelas públicas más selectas de Inglaterra, Rugby, y en el King's College de la Universidad de Cambridge. Entre los títulos que jalonan su amplia trayectoria destacan Hijos de la Medianoche, Vergüenza, Los Versos Satánicos, Harún y el Mar de las Historias, El Último Suspiro del Moro, Furia, Shalimar el Payaso y La Encantadora de Florencia, que se acaba de publicar en español. Hijos de la Medianoche, su gran novela épica sobre la India, además de alzarse con el premio Booker, uno de los más prestigiosos de la lengua inglesa, el año de su publicación, fue elegida Booker de los Bookers, es decir, el mejor de los títulos distinguidos con el galardón, en 1993 y 2008, años que marcaron respectivamente el 25 y el 40 aniversario de la fundación del premio. Antes de empezar, un fuerte aplauso de bienvenida para nuestro invitado. Someone told me that they had read an interview recently here in Colombia, where they asked you, "Well, you have written extensively about religious issues. Has it ever been a problem for you?" Okay. Now, my question is: let's imagine that the whole thing about the fatwa never happened, and you just had written the book, Midnight's Children. Now, let's go to that imaginary moment in time, and the question would be, what can you tell us about this book? What made you write it? What is the purpose behind it? And how long did it take you? So let's talk about this book.
Which book, sorry?
Midnight Children.
Midnight's Children. Well, it took me a long time. It took me 6 years, almost 5.5 years. Can you hear me? Yes? No. All right. Yeah, all right. Like this. God, it's like being a pop singer. You have to have sex with the microphone. No. Okay. Actually, let's just do that. No. Sorry. I wanted to write about, I started out wanting to write a much more modest novel. I wanted to write a novel about childhood. And I thought that I would use the material of my childhood, for obvious reasons, and that was as big as my ambition was. I didn't have this much grander historical project. And then at a certain point, basically, I remembered a joke that my parents used to tell, which they told much too often. I mean, it was not that funny the first time. And the 1,001st time, it was even less funny. But the joke was that I was born in June 1947, and 8 weeks later, the British ran away. As if there was some connection between these events, my part in the revolution. At the age of 8 weeks, I chased the British out of India. And at some point, I thought, well, there doesn't really have to be even the 8 week gap. That, how about if the child was born at exactly the same time as the country? And I realized suddenly two things. One was that that was probably a good idea, and the other is that it completely changed the conception of the book. Because if you make the child and the country, so to speak, twins, then you have to tell the story of both twins. And at that point, the whole subject of history rushed into the book, and it became five times as long and much more difficult to write. And from that point, it took me more than 5 years.
How long? More than 5 years. Okay. Now I assume that the reaction to the book took you completely by surprise.
You know, I was just happy that it got published, because I thought I've written this colossal, you know, what, a 650-page novel, which is kind of weird. It's written in a weird way, and it's not about English people. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's hardly any English people in it, or even white people in it. And I was happy that it found a publisher, you know, and I thought that if it was read by a couple of thousand people who were not my friends or related to me, that would be good. Instead, what happened was, yes, completely unexpected and joyful, you know, especially the reaction to the book in India, which was colossal and very emotional, in fact, for the readers as well as for the author, you know. So it became a very important moment in my life. Yeah,
you had to write it being away from India. That seems to be essential.
I don't know if that was essential. I mean, I think I did. I went to India for 6 months before I started writing it. That was essential also. I think the only thing is that, you know, the book is ludicrously, almost kind of comically ambitious, because it has the idea that you could contain the whole of India in a novel. And one of the things that is obvious when you go to India is that you can't contain one street in a novel, you know, let alone this continent with a billion people. Mm-hmm. And maybe I had to be far away from India in order to have the sort of absurd confidence to write such a book. But then afterwards, you know, when I was traveling in India, when the book came out, people would come up to me in different parts of India and they would say, you know, all you did was finish your book first, because I had the same idea. And they would show me chapters of books in which a boy is born at the moment of independence in Goa, you know, or in Bengal. And they said, you see, now I can't finish my book because you finished yours. And actually the nicest thing anybody said to me was a young person of my age at that time came up to me in Bombay and he said, I could have written your book. I know all that stuff. And I thought, you know, it is a compliment, because what he was saying was that the book expressed an experience that he felt he also shared, you know. And so I decided to take it as a compliment. There was another one. Can I tell you the other thing?
Yep.
There was a woman reader in Delhi, actually, who asked me a question. And she said, Mr. Rushdie, I read your novel, Midnight's Children. It is a very long novel. She said, never mind, I read it through.
That's a very good one.
She said, my question for you, she said, is the following. Fundamentally, what's your point?
What was the answer?
And so I opened my mouth and to answer. She said, no, I know what you're going to say. I said, yes. She said, yes, you're going to say to me that the whole novel from the beginning to the end, that's your point. Isn't that what you're going to say? And I said, well, yes, in fact, I was going to say that. She said, it won't do. And I said, well, you know, as you yourself have said, it's a very long novel. So do I have to have just one point? Or can I have more than one? She said, no, one point. So ever since then, I've been trying to find the answer to the question. So if anybody has anything to say, I'd be grateful. But
in a conversation we had a few days or weeks ago, maybe a month, and now that we are going over some, you know, humorous aspects connected with the book,
yes,
you said to me when I asked you, well, what did you miss about this book? I mean, about not being discussed properly due to the political circumstances surrounding it. And you said, you know, everybody missed a very important point, This is a comic book.
Yes. It's a thing not often said about the satanic verses, that it is funny. You know, but it is.
But not only that little yes, also about the technical procedures to create this novel. You made the point that you were more or less following Kafka's idea in the castle, that he builds a series of comic vignettes that add up to something which is not exactly comic.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I think one of the things not often said about Kafka either is that he's a very funny writer. And if you look at, in particular, the castle, I think, you know, every single scene in the castle is a comic scene. It's played as comedy. And yet the kind of cumulative effect is as we now say, Kafkaesque. I mean, it's not comic. But I think, but comedy is a thing that, you know, it's either how you write or it isn't. And if it is, you can't do anything about it. And if it isn't, you can't do anything about it. But for me, it's always been, I mean, I don't just to speak as a reader, not as a writer. I can't read with pleasure books whose authors have no sense of humor, no matter how great those authors are. I will not name them.
I was going to ask.
George Eliot. I made a terrible boo-boo in England once. I was on a TV program where they asked people, it was like Christmas, so everybody was feeling relaxed. And we were asked to admit great novels that we had never read. And I admitted that I had never been able to finish Middlemarch. And I was torn to pieces in the press. You know, he calls himself a writer. He can't read Middlemarch. You know, and I was really, it was proof of my absolute degraded status that I had not been able to read George Eliot. But I still have not read Middlemarch.
Good for you. Now,
and she's dead.
There's one element that goes across your entire work, but I want to split it in a couple of nuances, and it is the element of fantasy. But before we go to the more general question, I would like you to talk about your interest in science fiction and your first book.
Yeah, my horrible first book.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, if you would like to talk about it, maybe you should go ahead.
No, but I won't. Okay,
I mean, I know, I was, when I was young, like when I was 16, 17 years old, there was a period when I was obsessed with science fiction.
Yeah. Okay.
And I read enormous amounts of it. And not just what we would now acknowledge as kind of great science fiction, like Kurt Vonnegut or Philip K. Dick or Ray Bradbury or whatever, but a lot of really B-grade, D-grade, you know, Z-grade science fiction by people called things like C.M. Kornbluth and A.E. Van Vogt and Clifford D. Simak and L. Sprague de Camp and so on. I read all these people. And I thought then, and I still think, that it is at its best, it's an unusually good vehicle for the exploration of ideas. You can get very skillful novels of ideas that use a science fiction or fantasy format. And I liked it for that, and I still do. But there was a certain point where almost overnight, I lost interest. And I think it's for two reasons. One is that almost all science fiction is very, 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 very badly written. I mean, the writing is of the chimpanzee level. The accidental words created by chimpanzees as they hit the keys of a computer. You know, that's science fiction. And worse than that is characterization, and particularly the characterization of women. There are almost no credible women in the entire canon of science fiction. They're all either in white coats and technologists, or else they're huge-breasted, voluptuous fantasy figures. And just because of that, I stopped reading it completely. But it's, you know, like everything that you are obsessed by for any point in your life, it leaves its mark. And I think it did leave its mark.
Do you use fantasy now in a more general way in all your books, I would say, and or mostly in all your fiction? And it seems to me that behind that lies a conception of thinking that maybe so-called realism is not necessarily the best way to try and capture reality. There are other...
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's the way that I would put it, so to speak, as a grown-up, you know. But I think the real reason is earlier than that. It's to do with growing up in a world in which you are surrounded by wonderful tales. You know, as children, we all imbibe fantasy. And then most of us grow up and decide that it's childish. And I guess I'm one of the people who didn't make that decision. But the love of the fantastic in fiction was born out of being a child growing up in India and surrounded by all the collections of stories of the East, which are very fabulous in their nature, whether it's the Arabian Nights stories or the Panchatantra fables or the so-called Kathasaritsaga, the ocean of the streams of story, which is actually a longer compendium than the Arabian Nights, or the Hamzanama stories or the Hatim Tai adventures. I mean, there's many, many compendiums of wonderful tales. And what they tell you as a young writer is an obvious but important truth, which is that stories are not true, that the things that happen in stories did not happen, and the people in your stories did not exist, and that therefore realism is as much a fiction as fiction, you know, because you're writing about, you're telling lies. You're telling lies for a living and asking people to pay you for them. And so you may as well tell good lies. There's no reason why horses should not fly or carpets, you know, just because your bedroom is not full of flying furniture, it doesn't mean that it's in a story, furniture should not fly. And that decision that to agree with these fables of the past, that you can reach, you can tell a good story which tells certain kinds of truth, you know, human truth, rather than journalistic, if you like, truth. That's a liberation that I think any of us who grew up in that world, you know, should be grateful to the classics for. And that's certainly where it began with me. I mean, afterwards, of course, I discovered that there was a big global tradition of this kind of fiction. But I have to say that I think it's overstated the extent to which my novels are fantasy-driven, you know. Because, I mean, for instance, when Midnight's Children came out, people in India did not respond to it as a fantasy novel. You know, they responded to it as a realistic novel that happened to use certain elements of the fantastic. But they responded to the reality in the novel, not to the fantasy, you know, whereas by and large in the West, it was the other way around. So I've always thought that the idea of realism is confused too often with the techniques of naturalism. You know, that realism to me is an intention on the part of the writer to respond truthfully to the world, you know, and to try and express as much truth as he is able to do, or as his talent and imagination allows. And if that's what the book is trying to do, by whatever techniques, by whatever means, you know, I would call that a realistic novel. You know, I mean, I've had people who know much more about Latin America than I do explaining to me the realism of Garcia Marquez, mm-hmm. For example. And I respond to that. That's what I think. I think that people have got confused about what realism is and have equated it with naturalistic writing, And I don't think it necessarily is that.
Yeah, that makes me think a little bit of Shame, which is a novel that would be within the parameters of the reaction you described in India to other books before. But that book contains, to me, some elements that almost seem to be prophetic in the sense that the things you discuss or that you bring up in the novel are things that happened later on historically, like, you know, the...
I have this... I'm kind of worried by this tendency of my books to come true.
Yeah, okay.
And I wish they would stop.
Yeah.
You know, I was saying to somebody earlier that 12 years, 13 years ago, I was in Mexico and I went to the Guadalajara Book Fair. And afterwards, many of us writers who were there were taken for an excursion to Tequila to have a day of getting drunk. On very good tequila.
Okay.
And I remember being very struck by the place, even before the old tequila was produced. First of all, I didn't realize there was a place called Tequila. You know, there isn't a place called whiskey. there's no town called vodka or gin, you know, but tequila turns out to exist. Anyway, so I was very, I guess it stuck in my head, and many years, a couple of years after that, when I was writing my book, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, I needed to begin the book with an earthquake. This is, you know, the advice of the great intellectual Cecil B. DeMille, who once said about how you plot a movie, he said, you start with an earthquake, and then you build it up from there. So I thought that I'd do that. And so I decided to destroy tequila in my novel. So chapter one of the novel destroys tequila in a terrible earthquake. So I hope it doesn't come true. But it is true that I find about Shame in particular, actually, I mean, that this is a book which was published in 1983.
Yes.
You know, I mean, quarter of a century ago. And it feels more topical now than when I wrote it. And in a way, it shows that nothing changes, you know, because the kind of dynamic or the power dynamic that book was exploring between military and civilian power, between different kinds of corruption, civilian, military, and religious corruption, you know, in a kind of lethal dance. You know, I mean, that was happening then and it's happening now. So in a way, it's not that the book was prophetic as that the world has not changed. The only thing that's changed is that now those of us who are not Pakistani are more interested in Pakistan than we used to be because of how the world has moved on. And so you look at this book and you say, oh, well, this seems to be saying what I know. And that's, it's just a question of, in a way, what's changed is the attention of the audience to the subject has changed.
Well, now let's move out from the realm of literature for a second and go back to what was a very difficult moment for you. Everything had happened. I mean, the sentence had been declared. You were constantly surrounded by bodyguards. I remember I was talking to somebody the other day. There was a party for you, and the guests, I think it was Juno, told me, Juno Diaz, and the guests were told where the party was going to take place, like an hour in advance, something like that. But going deep inside yourself as a creator, in this festival, there was a session on, you know, censorship, internal censorship for you. Under those circumstances, having to create, to continue to write, I'm sure it was very, very, very tough, but I want you to, how did you, what were your main, what sustained you, and what were the difficulties?
I don't know, I think writers are very obstinate people. And I became, well, I was, for a time, it's true, I was very thrown off balance. And it was not easy to, well, it was impossible to work for a time period of many months, really. And then I just decided to get back to work, you know. And I think, I suppose, I mean, if I talk about it now, it sounds more, if you like, it sounds grander than it was, you know, because I did say to myself that I was not the first writer to be persecuted. And many of the other writers who had been persecuted had not given in and had, you know, not used it as an excuse to stop working. And I thought, well, if this is my turn, then I can't let the side down, you know. I mean, I have to go on as well. And I was a little bit, if you like, strengthened by the example of people who had gone before me, you know. And but really, what I thought was that the trouble with fear, which is the purpose of terrorism, you know, the purpose of terrorism is to create fear. If you give in to that, it's fear is a tyrant. You know, fear is an absolutist. If you are taken over by fear, you can't do anything else. All you can do is be afraid. And so in the end, at a certain point, you have a choice, which is either you're going to sit in the corner and shake for the rest of your life, or you're going to put it away in a little box and get on with your day. And I thought that I'd do that. I just decided I'm going to get interested.
Under those circumstances, which was the first book that you wrote?
I wrote the happiest book I ever wrote in my life. I wrote a children's book, Haroon in the Sea of Stories. And it's because I had promised my son that I would write a book. He was then 10, 11 years old. And I had promised my son that I would write a book. And I thought, you know, you should, if possible, not break promises to children. And so that was also a motivation that got me back to work. And I wrote a book, I think, with the only book I wrote with a completely legitimate happy ending, which I guess I've said before, but it's true. I had become unusually interested in happy endings at that time. And so I thought, let me at least try and create a happy ending for the father and son in the book. And, you know, if my books come true, then maybe it'll come true for me.
Yeah, there seems to be an encoded message in that book, like a message in a bottle or something, like you're talking to your child ahead in time when he grows up.
Well, it's, you know, it's a strange book because it is a grown-up book as well as a children's book. And I wanted it to be like that. And I mean, I thought, you know, if you go to the movies, it's quite common for movies to bridge that gap. You know, if you go and see, I don't know what, Star Wars, you know, is it for children or grown-ups? I mean, it's a question you don't need to ask. You know, it's for everybody. So I thought there must be a way in literature also of writing in such a manner that a child can read it and have childish pleasure. And a grown-up can read it and see that it's about more. And I thought maybe it would be like a message in a bottle. I thought if I write it, you know, I read, my son reads it when he's 11. I wanted him to enjoy it as an 11-year-old boy. And then I thought, well, he's going to grow up one day and he wanted to read it again. And he can see that it's about, you know, it's in a way about many of the things that were happening in his father's life and his life at that time.
Yeah, there are many other great books you have written, and we have not too much time to talk about all of them. But this one we must talk today, because it's your last book, which is The Enchantress of Florence, which also is coming out in Spanish. It already is here in Colombia. And to me, as a reader, the most powerful point about the book is the joy of language per se.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things I discovered when I was trying, you know, you always have to find the language for every book. You have to find the language for it. And one of the things that I responded very strongly to was the language of the 16th century, you know, which is, after all, is the century of Shakespeare, is the century of Cervantes. In Italy, it's the century of Ariosto. In India, it's the century of many, many great poets, many of whom were at the court of the Emperor Akbar, who is in the novel. And the characteristic of the language of that time is that it's no holds barred language. You know, it's language at maximum. You know, it's completely unbuttoned, flat out language. You know, it's not minimalist, it's maximalist. And I thought, you know, that's fantastic. That's, for me, it was a not just a liberation, but it was like an encouragement. It was to say, okay, you have to go for it too. You have to create a language which belongs to the language of that period, if possible. So you have to enrich, as much as possible, enrich your language. You know, so I tried to write it in this very lush language. But then, of course, the danger is, the danger of that always is overwriting. The danger that the danger is purple prose and kind of a kind of absurd, inflated grandeur that that is not merited by the things you're describing. But there's always a danger in any choice you make linguistically. But
it seems to me that that is very well controlled, because if you look at the last pages of the book, there's a substantial bibliography, but you seem to have been able to trim it down to, you know, a few
hundred pages. Yes, I read a lot of, I did my homework. It's true. And actually, again, the more I learned about the world of the 16th century, the more liberating it was, because the world was bizarre. The world was insane. And I thought, nothing I can make up will be out of place here, because look what they're really doing. You know, I mean, I would read about this warlord who kills, or the Shah of Persia, actually, who kills a rival warlord. And what he does is he chops his body up and sends the various body parts around the empire to prove that his enemy is dead. But he keeps the head, he boils down the skull, and he sets the skull with gold and jewels, and he makes a wine goblet, and he drinks wine out of it every night. And then after a while, he thinks, no, I've got a better idea than that. And he sends the wine goblet as a present to the Ottoman Sultan in Istanbul, basically saying, this is what I just did to my enemy on my east frontier. And since you're on my west frontier, maybe you would like a look. Yeah. And as a result of this, the Ottomans send a colossal army against Persia and defeat Persia, right? So the moral of the story is, if you're going to behave like that, don't do it to somebody who's more powerful than you. Yeah. But this is completely true. Now, if the world is like that, you can make anything up and it fits. And I found that over and over and over again. You know, there's a moment in Florence when the Medicis defeat the so-called Pazzi conspiracy, and they discover that they arrest all the conspirators and so on, decide to execute them. And one of the conspirators is the bishop. Mm-hmm. So they hang the bishop. They hang the bishop out of the window of the palazzo in his full regalia. Right? So you've got this pendant bishop hanging over the Piazza della Signoria, to the delight, of course, of the people looking up under his garments. And when the world is like that, it's a great gift to a writer. So all you have to do is, I mean, all the stuff I made up is very mild compared to the truth.
There's a character that epitomizes what you're saying, which is Machiavelli. What attracts you to him?
I always have a very soft spot for Machiavelli. Because you know, the truth is that we have done a great injustice to Machiavelli, all of us. Because the truth is that Machiavelli was not Machiavellian. He wasn't like that. He was kind of the opposite, really. And it's all because of this little book, The Prince, which is this, you know, harsh little treatise on the nature of power. But in my view, it's a classic case of shooting the messenger. You know, because Machiavelli was not a lover of princes. He was actually an enemy of the Medicis. And when there was a point where they actually tortured him and tried to kill him with instruments of torture, at least the equal of the ones in the museum that I saw last night. The favored torture instrument in Florence was a thing called the strappado. The strappado was where you tie somebody's hands behind his back, mm-hmm. and then you throw the rope over a pulley, and you pull him off his feet with backwards like that. Well, usually the first time somebody is treated with the strappado, they would confess to anything. They would confess to raping their grandmother, you know, just for it to stop. Machiavelli was subjected to it four times and confessed to nothing. And as a result, they were not able to kill him, so they had to only exile him. This is not a lover of princes. You know, this is somebody who has suffered terribly at the hands of princes. But what he saw all around him was the behavior of ruthless princes, the Medicis, the Borgia, the Sforza, all the great families of northern Italy at the time. And he made the mistake of writing down what he saw without trying to soften it. You know? And that little book actually contains one of the great questions of all time, which is what is the relationship between power and goodness? Is it possible for a prince to be just? Or is there something in the nature of power that obliges the prince to be unjust? You know, is it possible to be a good ruler? And he, disillusioned, cynical, broken, answers no. And he may be right. No, but to blame him for this, for simply seeing how the world was, you know, I think it's a great injustice. And so I thought that I'd like to. Also, Machiavelli was a lot of fun. He was clearly the life and soul of his circle of friends. I mean, actually, there's a letter that remains from one of his friends to him when he was away on business, which says, "Please come back soon, because when you're not here, there's nobody to organize the parties." You know, yes. So he was an attractive personality. He was a very good writer. He wrote the biggest hit comedy of the Renaissance, which was his play La Mandragora, The Mandrake Root. You know, is the most successful comedy of the whole Renaissance. So I wanted to rehabilitate Machiavelli.
Despite its complications and complexities, and despite some dark areas in the book, it seems to me that this is also a very happy book, in a sense that you, the author, are allowed to go back to where you had been before. And now that you seem to be in a new period of your life, you not only devote yourself to the celebration of language, but also to something that is very special in your case, which is the sheer pleasure of pure, simple storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's right, and it's reflected by, you know, the fact is that in your introduction was almost entirely political and not literary, you know, and that's, I came to feel very worried about the fact that this political noise that had surrounded me and my work was really obscuring not just the writing, but the man as well, you know, and that people didn't really understand what my books, I'm saying people who had not read my books, did not understand what kind of books they were or what kind of person their author was. And I think often that political stuff was very off-putting. You know? So I thought, I really want to try and, in a way, make a restatement, you know, to say, this is why I became a writer. I didn't become a writer to get into a fist fight with the Ayatollah Khomeini, which is an unfair fist fight because he's much older than me. And as you see, one of us is dead. You know, I wanted to tell stories. That's it. You know, I mean, it's not more complicated than that. And because I believe that there's something very profound. There's a very profound link between the telling of stories and the kind of animal that we are. You know, human beings from the very beginning have told stories as a way of understanding their world and as a way of understanding themselves. Now, it may be that early stories were sacred stories or became sacred. Later stories have not been necessarily sacred stories, but the telling of stories has been our way of understanding ourselves. And I mean, I'm not talking about professional writers now. You know, and I think, you know, if you think about families, for example, you know, all families have stories. And some of those stories are that the family is proud of, and some the family is kind of ashamed of, but those are the family stories. And knowing those stories is, if you like, the proof that you are a member of the family. You know? And when people enter a family, you know, when a child is born or somebody marries into a family, they are slowly told the stories of the family, and eventually they belong. So stories have that kind of capacity to unite us and identify us. And, you know, nations have national stories. I mean, that's to say, we live in a world shaped by the telling of stories and the retelling of stories. We are this interesting and unusual creature. We are the storytelling animal. You know, there is no other animal on earth that tells stories. It's only us. And as a result, I believe the telling of stories is part of the definition of what it is to be us. It's part of the definition of what it is to be a human being. And that is why I thought it was unusually important work to do, you know, when I started out. And that was it. I just wanted to find very good stories to tell and tell them. And now I'm able to do it again. And hopefully there's one or two more left.
And like always, I think bridging the East and the West.
Yeah, yeah. And also knowing when to shut up, you know. I mean, the great lesson of Scheherazade is the end of every day, every night in the Arabian Nights ends with the same sentence. It ends when it says, "She saw dawn approaching and fell quiet discreetly." That's how she lives, by never finishing the story. So that silence is important as well as language, you know, in telling a story. And it's an inexhaustible subject. It's an inexhaustible subject, and it's one which is only limited by your talent. That's the only limit, you know, and should be the only limit.
In your case, we need not be worried. Questions for Mr. Salman Rushdie?
Can we have some lights? Are you there? Did you all go home? All right, there's some of them are still there. Right, right. Thank you. Okay. Now, yes, yeah.
Hi. When referring to your novel, The Enchantress of Florence, you spoke of the people in the 16th century. And you said that they believed more in magic than they did in religion because they actually thought it was true. Speaking nowadays of modern societies, 5 centuries later, not only of people, but also of yourselves, what do you believe in? And what do people believe in?
What do I believe?
What do you think you and people believe in nowadays? If they believed in magic in the 16th century because they thought it was real, in the 21st century, what do they believe in?
I don't know. I try to do without belief. I mean, I think that's actually, I'm not trying to avoid the question, but it's what I think. I mean, I don't take things for granted. But let me contradict myself, because I think the imagination, the act of dreaming things up, is not subject to the same laws as your ordinary rational self. So I can spend most of my day not believing in a God and being, you know, convinced of the virtues of reason and proof and skepticism and so on and so on. But when I write my books, something much stranger goes on, and I don't fully understand it, because you could actually, and I can see myself, you could look at these books and see them as containing many traits which might be described as being the work of a religious writer. And it's partly to do with an inadequacy of language. I mean, there are because religion has been so important for so long in human history, there are many linguistic constructions which can't be done without. I mean, like, for example, just to take the idea of the soul. Now, if you are not religious, that word should have no meaning. I mean, let's say if you don't believe in a life beyond death, something of you that is immortal and survives, then a word like the soul should be a word which has no meaning for you, you know? And yet it clearly does have a meaning, I think, for all of us, whether we're religious or not. And it's because we all have an instinct that we are not entirely, you know, skin and flesh and bone, and that there is, as Arthur Koestler said, a ghost in the machine. And the question is, what is that? And there is no word for that other than the religious word. So sometimes you find yourself forced into religious language to express an instinct that you have for which you have no proof, but there's no rationality to it. And I still don't accept the religious explanation of the soul, but I also can't fully believe in a completely materialist universe. So there's a conflict, you know? And it's a good conflict because books come out of it. And in a way, I don't particularly want to resolve the conflict because that might be problematic for the books. You don't want to be too much of a thinker, I think, as a writer, you know? You want to be a writer. Leave the thinking to other people.
It's part of the fun. There's time for one more question.
Over here? Oh, there, is there somebody? Where is it? Yeah.
Son dos chiquitas. ¿Cuál es la importancia que le dan al sentido del olfato a la hora de hacer describir situaciones y personas? Y la segunda es curiosidad. ¿Cómo hizo Helen Hunt para convencerlo de hacer el papel de ese ginecólogo bondadoso en la película Then She Found?
Well, one of the two questions is very good. as far as the fatwa is concerned, I don't think about it in terms of my daily life, really. Certainly not in terms of my work. Helen Hunt is a whole much more complicated question. I didn't know Helen Hunt and had no expectation that she would offer me a part in a movie. But they called up and they said they were interested and would I be interested to play the important role of Helen Hunt's gynecologist. So, of course, I said yes. But it wasn't as easy as that. I had to go and do a full video audition and compete against other actors. And that the greatest pleasure, actually, was afterwards, a couple of friends of mine who are actors of Indian origin living in New York, when they heard that I'd done this movie, they said, oh, well, I went up for that part. And I was able to say smugly that I beat them out. Then there was some method acting involved. I had to go to study how gynecologists work. I had to spend a day or two in OBGYN rooms being taught how to work ultrasound machinery, things like that. So, yeah, so now if anybody wants an ultrasound, I am able to perform one.
un segundo. Me han pedido que sea muy estricto con el tiempo, de manera que para terminar simplemente les quería decir, en Cartagena de Indias, Colombia, en el Festival Hey, un gran aplauso para un autor recuperado para la literatura.
Thank you.